cliffcentral.com.
Peter Boghossian is a full-time faculty member at Portland University, and he's taking a break from his sabbatical to talk to us on cliffcentral.com. I've been a long-distance admirer of his work for some time, and he's been involved in many topics, many subjects, many discussions and conversations that have caught my eye, and I would expect would have caught many people's eye across the world, not only here in South Africa. He's an assistant professor of philosophy, among other things, but he works with the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science and the Secular Student Alliance, among others. Peter, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your show. Let me apologize before we get started. I have somewhat of a cold, and so if I cough, please excuse me.
Not a problem. And my condolences on your dad's death. I know that that's a very, very difficult thing for anyone to go through. Just a few days ago, it makes it even more impressive that you've taken time out of your day to talk to us. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. It was quite a shock, and I've lost both of my parents now, and so navigating this reality with people who have always been there supporting me in my life is a rather different way to be in the world.
You know, if you don't mind, could we start there? Because I've often thought, as someone who doesn't really have a faith, that it is probably harder for people who don't have a faith to deal with death because it is so final in so many ways. Perhaps there is comfort for people who are religious in ceremony and ritual, in a set of beliefs, mythologies perhaps, that make them feel a little more comfortable that they'll see their loved ones again. I think maybe for people like us, it's a little more tough.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things I've been thinking about is, so I'm going through my dad's and photos with my mom and my grandparents, and when you let go of the idea that life has some ultimate purpose, that there's some ultimate meaning in which everything you do is written down somewhere or will exist eternally, when you truly let go of that, I think, at least for me, it's made every moment in my life more precious. It's given me an awareness of the finality of things. That's why it's always been very unusual to me to hear people say, well, you have no meaning in your life if you're an atheist or if you don't hold these beliefs. But it seems to me that's exactly the opposite. It's only because the idea of ultimate purpose doesn't enter into the calculus, doesn't enter into every moment in your life, that you really can be appreciative and present in the moment, because this is all you have. And there's nothing etched in stone out there.
And I suppose that every conversation as a result of that philosophy matters. Every conversation has to matter because your time is almost more precious. You don't have an eternal life to look forward to.
Yeah, and it's coupled with the fact that there's almost a kind of tragedy, almost a perverse tragedy in thinking that something you did good for somebody will kind of count as a karmic point towards some reward you get afterward. It demeans the goodness, the essential goodness of things that you do, little things, small things. I was fortunate enough, and then I got to hold both my parents' hands at their death. And that was an incredibly meaningful moment in my life. And I don't need any supernatural entity to validate that for me. I don't need it. It's a kind of standing on your own two feet. And I think, you know, now that my both of my parents have died, I think that that's one of the things that we see when we relinquish a supernatural figure or a father figure or some agent up there looking down on us and controlling our actions. It really is an opportunity to stand on your own two feet and to make decisions yourself. And that's a gift.
Now, there are obviously different kinds of atheists. The central idea is that you don't have a belief system, but it isn't really a thing. It's like being a non-flat earther to some of us. It's not really it's not something we go around telling people we are. But you do get people. I mean, I remember the late Christopher Hitchens saying that he was very much an anti-theist, that he was pleased that there wasn't anything supernatural and there wasn't this dictatorial power in the sky, this totalitarian regime that lasted long after your death. He said that that was a good thing and that he would be pleased if it were not true. What is atheism, when you explain it to someone, particularly to, you know, the vast population of the vast majority of the population of the world is clearly a religious population. When they hear atheist, what do you think they hear, and how do you explain your position to them?
I think they hear bad person. I think they hear this person is really confused and maybe even a liar. I think they hear this is an excuse for immoral behavior. And I think that they feel sad for the what they consider to be an atheist. So I think in any kind of conversation, what's important are the terms that we use in defining those terms. I define atheist as someone who doesn't have sufficient evidence to believe in God, but if I were given sufficient evidence, I'd believe.
And it's that simple.
It really is that simple. I'm completely open to arguments. Look, the very fact that people think that there's still something to debate means that it hasn't been settled. But at the end of the day, once those debate points all fall by the wayside, it always comes down to my faith, my personal experience, my feelings that I have. But those aren't reliable guides to reality. We know in the Quran, for example, that it says that Jesus was not crucified. And we know that that's a core belief of, I would say, almost all, but certainly most Christians. And so the idea that your feeling state can lead you to the truth about something is just false. And we literally have billions of people harboring under false conceptions of reality. Because it can't both be correct that Jesus was crucified and that Jesus was not crucified.
Mm. But what about those people who say to you, oh, well, my feelings, that's my truth. You know, I hear this argument from some people.
Yeah, well, you hear it from the current administration, too, alternative facts. So my response to that is you don't believe that in any other area of your life. So, for example, you don't believe that when you walk into a bank, you wouldn't try to cash a $100 bill and say, well, my truth is that this is equal to 50 $50 bills.
Right.
No, because you – right. So – and I think people confuse matters of taste with matters of fact. Matters of taste are things that you – your senses. You know, I like this kind of music, like I'm drinking coffee right now with almond milk. I like almond milk in my coffee. Some people don't like almond milk. Trump was criticized ridiculously, in my opinion, for putting ketchup on a well-done steak.
I saw that.
So that's just – he can't be wrong about that. That's just how he likes his steak.
Right.
But you can be wrong about whether or not there was an historical figure named Jesus and whether or not that figure was crucified. And in fact, in those beliefs are even worse because they relate to matters of ultimate concern, how you live your life on a daily basis, whether or not you abstain from pork products, how many times a day you pray, where your genitalia should or should go and how you act upon that. So these are very profound beliefs that people have. They're empirical beliefs, and we're simply not being honest about the fact that at least a billion people are fundamentally wrong in their beliefs about something that's constitutive of their moral reality. And the only people who are being honest about that are fundamentalists or extremists in the religion.
Yeah, and the softer versions of those religions, the ones where perhaps they've watered down or cherry-picked the parts of the original texts that they like, they can't claim veracity because there are people more fundamentalist and therefore more religious and therefore more faithful and therefore more likely to be in the heaven of that religion than they. So there isn't even a position for them.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up because I want to talk about something where I think the entire conversation has gone awry. The entire conversation has gone awry because we continue to talk about correct or incorrect interpretations of a text. This is absolutely the wrong way to look at the problem. So you have creative writing experts like Reza Aslan on the left.
Yeah.
I'm even hesitant to say his name or on the left, who will tell you, and oddly enough, he happens to be correct about this, that there is no correct or incorrect interpretation of a text. So it is entirely possible that I could give the book of Yeronchuk to somebody, and they could look at that, as I'm trying not to use the Abrahamic traditions because it's too close to people, and they could look at that and infer from that that that's some kind of a recipe for, you know, what you put on your steak. Okay.
Right.
So while in philosophy there's something called hermeneutics, it's a discipline of interpretation pioneered by these two philosophers, Schleiermacher and Dilthey, and they wanted to ask whether or not there are correct or incorrect interpretations of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's solve this problem once and for all. Let us absolutely forget about, put aside the notion entirely of whether or not there are correct or incorrect interpretations of a particular text. That is a misleading and irrelevant question. The question that people should be asking themselves is there a more plausible interpretation of a text? Is this line from this text, is it more or less probable that we should, I don't even want to say something pejorative or negative about the religion, you know, that we should abstain from alcohol or pork products? And I think if we make this shift that from correct interpretations of a text to plausible interpretations of a text, that it exposes many of the charlatans on both sides of the equation. Because remember, here's the other thing you have happening. You have people who are not members of a religion taking the strictest interpretation of a text and then deeming people who don't follow that interpretation of a text as fundamentalists. And they're not even part of the religion in which they're making this judgment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nonsensical.
Yeah, the whole thing is it's astonishing. In religion has been traditional or textual interpretation has traditionally been given a pass because we don't want to offend people or we don't want to hurt people's feelings. But we are now living in an interconnected world, and we're talking about some extremely significant issues that have profound consequences for our lives. So we need to add this to the list of things, topping the list of things about which we need to have an honest conversation. And for whatever reason, I have my own opinion about why this is, but for whatever reason, we have forces that are almost conspiring against us to prevent honest conversations. So the question comes in my mind is, how do we have an honest conversation about social, political, and moral issues? A conversation that we need to have without bowing to the sensibilities of others or people being offended. How do we squarely place the conversation back upon what the truth claims are, what the empirical claims are, and then have a look at that? And I think that coupled with figuring out whose opinion matters and whose doesn't, my writing partner James Lindsay just tweeted that out, that's going to be one of the most important questions that we have to deal with as we move forward.
A lot of people, before we get into the interpretation of texts and that kind of thing, a lot of people want to know why, and I'm looking for the answer to this question. I still haven't had a satisfactory version of it. Why is faith a good thing? Faith essentially is the belief in something without any good evidence to back it up. Why would people have perverted the idea of having evidence for something, which is usually a good basis for it to be true, throwing that out of the window and saying, no, the opposite is the virtuous road?
That's a really good question. I think that depending on who you ask, people have different answers to that question. Ultimately, it does come down to, in philosophy, we use the word epistemic or epistemology, which is knowledge, how one knows what one thinks one knows. Ultimately, it comes down to epistemic hygiene. We want to proportion our beliefs to the evidence and not go beyond what the evidence tells us to. Now, we can make reasonable inferences about things. You know, the famous, how do you know you have faith your wife loves you?
Mm.
Well, look, here's the difference. My wife is a real person. She lives with me in the house. Actually, I'm in my dad's house right now, so she doesn't live. But I have pictures of our wedding. In fact, I was just looking through them the other day. I just spoke to her 15 minutes before this. I get checks that come into the account that I see. So I have all of these pieces of evidence that cohere to form a picture of my wife.
Right.
We don't have that with the Gospels. We don't even know that there was an historical Jesus. There likely was, but that seems to be a point of some controversy.
And the Gospels can't even agree on what the actual facts of that person's life were.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to bother people because they use faith as a placeholder. So look, let's even take a step back from this. The longer that I've been doing this, the more I've come to the conclusion that it's more important for people to consider themselves as good people than it is to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a strong sense of moral identity that overrides their rational mind. And I think faith is both the linguistic placeholder, kind of as the word faith, and I think it's something that people use to show others and themselves that they're a member of a virtuous community and themselves a good person.
Right. It's like those people who wear a cross around their neck or they wear a hijab or, you know, they virtue signal in a way.
Yeah, because the hijab might be forced, but the cross certainly is not. So yes. They want to show other people that they're good people.
Right.
And the problem, the thing that amazes me about this is not that the people who believe this buy into it. Stephen, that might not be true. Dennett and Pinker actually question whether or not that's true. The problem is that everybody else believes it.
Hmm.
The problem is that everybody else, atheists, believe that if someone says they're a person of faith, they're a good person.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be that way because you should be a person of evidence and you should have a track record. And perhaps we should look at that rather than just your protestation that you believe in something which you can't substantiate.
Yeah, and if I may bring this back to my dad's death, my dad was, his sense of identity as an Armenian was very important to him, and his parents were immigrants to this country. All my grandparents are immigrants. I wanted to have the funeral at the Armenian church, and my dad was friends with the priest, although my dad was an atheist and he never believed any of it anyway. So I said to the priest, who's a very, very nice man, I said, you know, I understand that you're religious and I'm not even asking you to cancel all the God talk or forgo it, but I'm asking you to really, just for me to tone it down. And he said, yes. And so then I asked him again to make sure we're on the page and he said, sure, no problem. So I gave my dad's eulogy. And I was just sobbing the whole time. It was kind of a mess. And at the end of that eulogy, he said, those were the tears of the Holy Spirit flowing through this man. And he started talking about the Holy Spirit. And I was just too bereaved at the moment to tell him to just, please, I can't take it right now. I'm having a difficult enough time dealing with this. And your delusions on top of this. I did realize the reason I told him to not, you know, that he could keep some God talk into it and to not nix the whole thing was because I did realize that some people have a need for this in their lives. And while I'm not going to – it's not my place to tell other people what to do or what to think. I can help them question and challenge and – be a partner with them and as they explore their beliefs, but I'm not some kind of a hegemon. You know, I'm not a dictator, and that's gets back to your comment about Christopher Hitchens being a celestial dictator. So, but my larger point is that, you know, some people are so into this that they don't even see it, they don't even understand it, and their faith lives are interwoven completely, and interwoven is a very polite word. It's more like a parasitic relationship, interwoven into their consciousness. And what's interesting to me about this is how do we help people to become more reflective of those beliefs, particularly when it's part of their identity and their moral lives? And those two components, thinking that it's entirely truth-driven, as opposed to having an identity component or a strong moral component, is where most atheists go awry in their conversations.
Well, this is an appropriate time then for me to ask you about something you've written about extensively. And it's something that I often am faced with answering, and perhaps you have the most eloquent answer here. Do morals come from religion, and is it possible for a moral person to exist outside of religion? I think you and I have an answer, but how would you say to someone who had never left a religion, who'd never understood a world outside of those moral codes, be it the Ten Commandments, the Quran, the Torah, whatever it might have been, that these people might have only ever associated their being good with being taught that religious stuff early on?
Okay, so there are two parts of your question. The first thing you said was, okay, so there are two parts of your question. The first thing you said was something about the bundling of morals and religion.
Yeah.
Every religion, as far as I know, even Universalist Unitarians, they have some kind of moral system or code. Here's the problem. As I mentioned before, we have competing moral codes. But the deeper problem is, if and I would extend this not just to religion, but for many of those, particularly those on the left, but also those on the right, who tend to take up social justice causes as a religion and want to quell speech and are absolutely convinced that they're correct and they think everyone who disagrees with them is a bad person and a moron.
Right.
If your values are not rationally derivable, then they're arbitrary. Let's take a moment to let that sink in. I'm going to say that again. If your values are not rationally derivable, then they're arbitrary. If you can't reason to your values, then the values that you have are capricious. They're subject to you're suffering from a sort of a cultural myopia and a moral myopia. In other words, you're a victim in a very real sense. In this case, you actually are a victim of your culture's morality, whether that's about sexual claims. You know, there's some wonderful stuff about how sexuality is a cultural construct. The problem with religion is it says that there are certain rules, certain moral, immutable moral rules. And once you say that, then you've lost the ability to revise those moral rules. But if you're so you can't both say that my moral rules are rationally derivable and that they're objectively true, because if they're rationally derivable, then they have to be subject to revision. And look, it's like when someone says to you, well, my beliefs are formed on the basis of evidence. And you say to them, okay, well, what evidence could I give you? This is a version of the defeasibility test. Mm-hmm. What evidence could I give you to help you revise your belief? And they say to you, well, there is no evidence. Well, then your beliefs aren't formed on the basis of evidence. Because to be formed on the basis of evidence means that there's another piece of evidence that could come in to make you revise your belief. So your first question is, there is a close relationship between religion and morals, and that every religious system also has a set of moral precepts and guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
But those are not rationally derivable. Anytime something is made sacred, anytime it's made holy, any of that stuff, you've thrown reason out the window. So an objective inquirer can't get to those values. Look, that's why people need to proselytize. Mm-hmm. They need to proselytize because you can't rationally derive that Jesus was the Son of God or that Muhammad received revelations in the desert. You get that because you tell other people, usually by a sword or a gun or guilt or some overarching feeling state that you try to avoid, fear. So that was the answer to your first question. How's that so far?
I like it. You're very sensible about these things because I'm so far in complete agreement. And of course, I could never hear an argument counter to my position.
Okay. And now you said the second – can you be – what was the second thing?
The second part is really about the idea of good people existing outside of religious moral codes, that there are people who don't have a religion that can do as much good as people who are inside the religion.
Yeah, that was Christopher Hitchens. You don't need religion to be good or bad. And you know, the other thing is, I'm 50 now. The older I get, the more important I realize that some core moral values like kindness and empathy and dependability and just being a decent person, and sometimes, not every time, that's where I disagree with Hitchens, but sometimes, maybe even more often than not, those religious systems overwrite or skew our moral intuitions. And so I think that's problematic, because again, I think it's, you're not standing on your own 2 feet and really thinking through these things. You just have an acceptance, even if it's an acceptance in which you this is the tricky part. Even if it's an acceptance in which you've evaluated those propositions or those moral statements, I think that the main thing that religious people who are religious or people who hold a particular faith need to hold is that the thing that they need to understand is that other people, you can be a good person with religion or you can be a good person without religion. And what matters are basic acts of decency and kindness toward your fellow human beings. And that's independent of any religion.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I think it's an important point to draw a distinction on, because a lot of people would imagine that the two have to go hand in hand. And as you said earlier, that you want to signal to other people you're a good person by saying you're a person of faith. And that with that comes a package of morality that you just plug in. It's almost like software that comes with a good laptop that you buy.
If you really want to value being a good person, then your first order of business is to figure out what it means to be a good person. I mean, Plato talks about that. He said people don't knowingly do bad things. And when you talk about that question with prison inmates, they overwhelmingly agree with you. I worked in the prison system, did my
dissertation. Absolutely. Yeah, I would love to ask you a little bit about the prisons and the reform and the kind of Socratic thinking that you've taken to prisons, because that's something that is very individual and unique. A lot of this stuff is perhaps stuff that you and I have spoken about before on other fora, but that's something that I'm very interested in. But before we move off of the religion stuff, a question that's been asked of Professor Richard Dawkins, and I'm sure it's been asked of you a couple of times, is would you be happier if the world didn't have any religion? Do you think the world would be a better place without religion?
Absolutely, unquestionably, yes. I think we would absolutely be better off without religion. There's no question about it whatsoever. And to that end, if you think that your religion, if you really think that your religion is true, and that you think it's rationally derivable, the precepts of your religion, the moral precepts or the empirical precepts, if you actually believe that, then what you should be doing is teaching your children critical thinking and not teaching them anything about religion, and they'll just come to the truth on their own, right?
that's sort of an inconvenient argument for people who believe that faith is a better option than inquiry.
I can't discredit it. And so it makes me believe. It certainly leads me to think that they might not believe that their religion is true. And again, I think when we start thinking about why people believe preposterous things, you know, Shermer's written some great stuff about this. Or when we start thinking about this, the more I've done this, the more I realize that it's less about because they think it's true, and it's more about their identity, their community, their morality. And I think we need to start thinking about conversations and people's beliefs in terms of those three components as opposed to the truth components.
Well, if it is community and identity and belonging, which is an important human quality, a human characteristic, something that most humans want to have and aspire to have, then in the case of the Armenian identity that you have, there must be some kind of Christian Armenian, you know, sort of Orthodox Christian Armenian identity wrapped up in all of that, even if for you and your father, you didn't really partake in the religion. It's like a lot of secular Jews I know who are very proud of being Jewish, but they couldn't care for the rituals and the synagogue and the holy days and all of that stuff.
Every time I talk about pride, it gets me in trouble. But I don't think you – so I don't really have that much of a sense of Armenian identity. My father did. But I think that you're correct. I've always questioned the notion of pride in that sense. It seems to me that you can only be proud of something that you've worked to accomplish and not an immutable characteristic.
Yourself, yeah, and something that you didn't have other people do for you.
Yeah, like you can't be proud of an accident of birth.
Right.
You can be proud of something you worked for.
Yeah.
I've mentioned that in relation to homosexuality, and people have gotten very upset. But I think it's true. And I think we need to be more careful about the way we use language. I think we need to be more thoughtful and more mindful about what we say we're proud of, or what we say, how we use words, you know, whether the word is faith, hope, or trust. And now we're living in a society, in a culture, in a time in which truth is absolutely under siege. It was under siege for a long time in the academy by the left, and it actually institutionalized to a certain extent in philosophy departments, with not just philosophy departments, with postmodernism. Mm-hmm. But now we have an administration that has an absolutely callous disregard for the truth, an anti-science administration.
Right.
We have the head of the EPA, who in my mind has committed crimes against sentience and should be, I don't know, we need a special kind of Nuremberg punishment for people like this. So yeah,
I saw you tweet about that the other day. You said, can we please stop worrying about what condiments Trump puts on his steak and focus on the EPA and their possible 25% cut under this lunatic administrator they've just put in?
Yeah, okay, so that's the other thing I think I'm going to use as an opportunity to talk about, if you don't mind.
Sure.
There's only so much I can do, or Harris can do, or whoever can do about bringing people on the far left to the adult table to have a rational conversation about policy to help us constructively engage the lunatics who currently occupy the White House. Trump and his henchmen, I think David Frum tweeted out something like, Trump is the worst president we've ever had, and that includes all the slaveholders. There is only so much that you can do. There's only so much criticism of the left. There's only so much criticism of identity politics. It's hard to not continue to rail against the left, the far left, given that democracy is under siege, people's opinions and voices are rooted in the color of their skin and then disregarded accordingly, violent protests in some cases. But at a certain point, we have to say, you know what? We have a larger threat here. We have tried to bring these people into the discourse to have a rational conversation to see what we can do. But instead, they're wearing vagina caps on their heads at marches, and they're behaving like – I don't even know what they're behaving like. They're behaving like
– Children.
Children, yeah. They're behaving like they should be seated at the kids' table and really have no voice in any kind of discussion that involves mature adults. And then we need to forget about them and focus our attention on the immediate problems at hand. The problem is that the Democratic Party in this country is besieged by radicals, and the country itself is – again, I retweeted something about Trump's rise, and I published something about this in Quillette magazine, being a direct response to political correctness.
Mm.
And you've had experiences with that yourself. I've had experiences with that. And the difference is, while people went after your career, in what I do in academia, it's become institutionalized. And so there's only so much ignoring we can do to these things when we have a larger threat, particularly the threat from the Trump administration with regard to the environment.
Yeah, I also think that it's probably it's time now for people to put aside their ideologies and to perceive the greater threat, which you rightly point out, is that you have people who hold even more dangerous ideas, perhaps, if you're going to value, you know, some ideas are much worse than others. And that these people are not only wearing pussy hats and taking riots to the streets, but they're also in charge of major government offices. And this could cause havoc in the administration and for the public at large, for the very system in which people operate.
That's right. And they've certainly infested academia, and they've certainly trained a generation of people who will become leaders.
And the worst part, Peter, sorry to interrupt you, it looks to me like the left, instead of moving to the center and becoming the only sane people in the room, the left seem to want to double down on their crazy and head in the opposite direction.
That is an excellent, excellent point. That's why I think what we see happening now, and I can only speak for this country, we see the emergence of a new center. We see the I don't know if it's a coalition that will coalesce at some point, but we see a center based not necessarily on policy positions, but upon ways to approach issues. So you see people who wouldn't ordinarily make good bedfellows, like I just heard the Sam Harris, David Frum podcast, really coming together to talk about an egregious, perhaps species-threatening problem. Look, so here's the other thing. If you were to write down a list of things that, say, I believe and, say, someone on the left believes, that list would be fairly close just in terms of policy proposals about gay marriage, about legalization of marijuana, about, you know, the Trump administration overturn the Clean Streams Act, about, you know, basic having a basic social safety net. We might disagree upon what those income levels are, or whether or not what the graduated income tax should be, there would be a lot of agreement. The problem is that those on the left will savage who should be their traditional allies about pretty minor policy disagreements.
Yeah, or the fact that you don't necessarily believe gender is a societal construct, that you actually think biology might have something to do with it. This is suddenly, to some people on the left, a controversial position.
Yeah, we can talk about that. That is absolutely astonishing. I gave a guest lecture in my buddy's class who's covering for me. I'm on sabbatical now. And I said something – I gave an example of how ridiculous it is that people think that sex – not gender, but that sex is a cultural construct. And I gave examples of that about women on – why are there no women on professional football teams, et cetera. And the reaction of some student started screaming, fuck you, and gave me the middle finger and ran out of class and was all upset. But look, I can't be held hostage to the irrationality of somebody in class who is a reality denier. In the same way that if it were a creationist or for anybody else, I'm totally – this is why we need to have systems in place that allow for rational discourse of problems, a rational discussion of a problem. And we don't have the infrastructure yet. Look, let me give you another a great example. Joe Rogan just tweeted out something about someone who was born a female who's transitioning to a male who's on testosterone, among other things, I assume. Mm-hmm. And they competed in a girls' wrestling tournament, and they won. So the champion of the state of the girls' wrestling league or whatever it is now a boy. But we need to have a rational conversation to lay out the moral infrastructure so that we can better understand how to engage these problems in the future, specifically in a democracy, without punching people in the face, without yelling at people, without smearing people. But we are so far from that now with increasing polarization. We're so far from that now with so many problems we encounter for something that should be so basic. And so when I say that sex is a biological construct, I am immediately attacked as somebody who is not for trans rights, which is just absurd.
Well, you're lucky if that's all, because sometimes they don't stop there. They'll call you a sexist, a misogynist, a racist. They'll call you a right winger. Before you know it, you're a Nazi. And so you do have to, you do have to now, if you want to remain friends with all of these people, you not only have to put up with those ridiculous gnomons that you didn't ask for, but now you also have to tread on eggshells because of everyone's feelings.
Yeah. And so what have they done in my case? People have gone around writing on the bathroom walls after I did an event with Dave Rubin and Christine Hoff Summers that Bogosian is a Nazi sympathizer because I said I don't want people who espouse repugnant views to be punched in the face. And so that gets back to our earlier point in the conversation. At some point, you just have to ignore these people to the best degree, to the degree that you are capable, relegate them to the children's table, and then focus on the problem at hand.
You're a big believer in prison reform, and you believe that there are ways of making sense of the way people have behaved that they should end up in prison that perhaps other people haven't thought of, and maybe even some of these things that are a little unconventional in their application.
Yeah, so this is an enormous conversation. We know, for example, that many of so now we need to take shots at both the left and the right. Many on the right discount the role of structural barriers in as a criminogenic factor. For example, there really are structural problems, school inequalities, problems in the home with drugs, with alcohol abuse, that make it less likely, not impossible, but less likely that certain kids will thrive and that make it more likely that they'll end up in prison. I think that the federal statistic in the United States, I can't generalize this to other countries, but it's you're seven times more likely to have to be incarcerated if one of your parents is incarcerated, and significantly more than that if both of your parents are incarcerated.
Right.
So the right needs to acknowledge that there are structural barriers preventing people's flourishing and actually leading them to some not nice outcomes.
Mm.
On the left, on the other hand, the left thinks that if you can just control institutions and society, that everyone is born a blank slate, thinking about Pinker's work now, that everyone is born a blank slate, and if you can just control those features, you can somehow produce the outcomes that you want. Well, the philosopher John Rawls, I think, solved this problem elegantly for us. We shouldn't be thinking about opportunity of outcome. We should be thinking of We should be thinking about opportunities. We need to give people the best possible opportunities, and what they do with those opportunities, that's ultimately up to them. And in the prison system, we see many of these people, not all of them certainly, but many of these people came from broken homes. That's something many on the left don't want to talk about, but whether or not there's an adult male present in the home is a big factor, and I was just reading Matt Thornton's forthcoming book about that. So we know that when it comes to prison reform, we know that a small investment in certain interventions yields huge dividends of these people. And I just want to pause myself and say, look, if anybody listening to this is saying, well, this is not my problem, well, you're absolutely false, because these people matriculate or go back into the communities. In one prison, in the prison in Portland, 80% of these people at Columbia Correctional Institution go back into the community in Portland. So this is absolutely everybody's problem, and we need to have a more thoughtful, rational discussion about how to allocate resources for prison reform.
I'm curious also, I mean, you're in a part of the country which is a very left-leaning state, and Portland in particular. I don't imagine there's too much in the way of diversity of thought in Portland. And I mean even slightly center, let alone slightly right.
That's absolutely correct. And when absolutely correct.
And when you talk about some of these things with regard to prison, I think a lot of people imagine that it should be like a holiday camp where you've got psychologists and you've got you know, carers and people dispensing psychiatric medicines and that kind of thing to prisoners. And then you've got, in the rest of the country, people who are very much hardliners who have no degree of any sympathy for people who end up in prison.
Yeah, and I want to speak to something you said, you just said about if you make a criticism of the left or the right, we somehow live in a culture, we find ourselves in a situation of intense tribalism, that is intense political tribalism. You can only criticize the other tribe. You can't criticize your guys. You can't criticize the guys on the left or guys right. And when you dispense that criticism equally, or maybe even not equally, but when you dispense it to somebody else, it's not only confusing to people, but it enrages people. So we know, to get back to the prison system, I do believe in second chances. I do believe that many of the people, because this is simply what the data shows, many of those people, if afforded certain opportunities. So for example, when I was the head of the prison advisory board of a prison, the first thing I did was I had a career fair, and I taught people how to make a resume, how to, you know, I mean, things that, if you'll excuse my bluntness, how to put on a condom, how to use condoms, you know, what is sexually transmitted diseases. And a lot of these people, they never have had people, educators, talk to them in blunt ways about these things. And we had a 100% participation rate. Every single person in the entire prison, and it was voluntary, came. So, you know, the other thing is you're sitting in those – it was always striking to me when I looked at prisoner schedules, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day, they're quote-unquote getting ready. They're – you know, it takes me, like, I literally roll out of bed, the alarm clock goes off, I scan my Twitter feed, and I run into the shower, and then I cook my kids breakfast. So we need to have modeling conditions from within the institution. And then the data has backed that up. So anyway, so the larger point is that we know that there are certain ways that people can be incarcerated that make it more likely that they will desist from criminal behavior. I want to articulate that for a second. I didn't say recidivate or not recidivate, because recidivation is just the percentage of people who get out and go back. I'm right. Specifically talking about people who desist from crime. And in that, there's a kind of moral triage in which we want the people who are violent criminals to desist from violent crime. That's our top priority.
You've said that people deserve dignity, but ideas don't deserve dignity. Now, to me, that's a very poignant and powerful statement. And when you're working with prisoners, I don't think anyone can really doubt that your intentions there are to understand the humanity and the dignity of these people, and to treat them probably, hopefully, better than they've been treated by a lot of other people in society. But it seems jarring to some people that their ideas aren't worth dignity. They almost will take it personally when you argue with them on a matter of religion, for example, whereas they won't if you bring up a person's human dignity. Very often take on that argument.
Right. Yeah, that's because of what has a theme that's emerged in this conversation, is that there are elements of their belief system that are intimately connected to their personal identity and to their moral identity. And when you challenge those beliefs, you're really challenging their perception of themselves as a good person. Prison inmates, it's very interesting that I found that the people who lack moral reasoning the most think they're the best at moral reasoning. Prison inmates are particularly interesting because they think that they're all experts in moral reasoning. And this also gets back to something we talked about in our conversation is that your moral beliefs should be rationally derivable. If they're not rationally derivable, they're arbitrary. And it's my notion that either I'm mistaken about moral notions that I have, or they're mistaken about moral notions that they have, given that we don't have the same moral notions. And so if it is the case that somebody is mistaken about a moral belief, then the most important thing we can do is we can ask how they know what they think they know morally, and see if their reasons for what they think they know actually lead them to legitimate conclusions about what they know. I've published these conversations online. If you go to, I don't know, Google Scholar or something, I transcribe these and I publish these conversations about a wide range of things, about leading a moral life, disposing of dead bodies, dictatorships, treating people cruelly, etc.
Yeah, I should actually point out, in case anybody is interested at this point, that you have written a manual for creating atheists.
Right, and the app is Atheos, and you can get that. And it basically guides people through a set of questions that they can have, that they can ask people who are of different faith traditions, who have different beliefs, and they can ask them a series of questions, and they can better understand the reasons that they have for their beliefs. And again, I want to come back to this notion that I think is just so important, that many on the right seem to have, but the left don't seem to have. And I think I might know why. I have a conjecture I'll share with you if you're interested. But it's that morality and the ideas that you have. Many on the left want to shut down the conversation about morality because they think they already have the truth. Whereas many religious people, in fact, virtually all religious people, if not all of them, don't. It could be because of a reference in 1 Peter 3:15 about, you know, kindly giving an explanation for what you believe. And it could be, this is my current thought, because religious people, Christians in particular, have a concept of redemption that the left doesn't have. The left has no concept of redemption. And I think those two features are particularly a toxic combination for the left's almost complete disregard for civil conversation.
Well, I think, isn't it also due to the cultural relativism? There isn't any way to evaluate anything because nothing should be made more superior or inferior to anything else.
Okay, so if you actually believe that, well, two things follow from that. One, don't criticize Trump, right? So if you actually believe that, right? So just, you know, and the second thing that follows from that is, well, when your kid gets sick, take him to the witch doctor.
Yeah.
So people who espouse that don't actually believe that.
So why do they crow it from the hilltops and the church towers? Why do they keep telling us how important it is to be politically correct and ideologically sensitive and to treat everybody's beliefs, even if they're stupid or dangerous beliefs, as being equal to those which have propped up civilization?
I this is only a speculation, but I think it's because at this particular time, that's part of the zeitgeist. That's a moral belief that governs our age, that they have latched onto.
Yeah, all we can do is speculate, right? I mean, I haven't heard a good argument against that position, to be fair.
Yeah, and part of the reason that you haven't heard a good argument is because they don't value, and I say they, and I realize this is a sweeping generalization, but I do think it's true. In general, these people tend to not value rational discourse in general, but they don't buy into the idea that morality is rationally derivable. They take their own moral intuitions as absolute facts, as kind of moral facts, overriding objective facts about the nature of reality, specifically the nature of moral reality. But if that's true, then and if they privilege their subjectivity, then they would have to privilege somebody like Pence. They would have to privilege his deranged moral view of reality.
Yeah, or someone you've also criticized, Huckabee. You know, those guys on the right. I mean, even Rick Perry. These are some of the most lunatic people in American society right now.
Yeah, I mean, Rick Perry is a guy who prays for rain, and now look at his current job. Now look what Trump has him. You know, belying the notion that, you know, I surround myself with the best people.
Yeah.
Huckabee has talked to all these people. These people are their thinking is so skewed. They are absolutely deranged. They're skewed by their own particular interpretation of religion. You know, Pence said he's first a Christian, then a conservative, then a Republican. And he's an evolution denier. He's a young earther. He's somebody for whom facts don't really – I mean, ostensibly he might say that they do. And what do we see the people on the left doing? They see the people on the left targeting Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Bill Maher and myself and who have you. They see the people on the left target the people who have more or less an ideological congruence or similarity with them. And while they don't give Pence a pass, and a friend of mine said something fascinating to me, and I think at one point in our conversation, I should probably bring it up. Mm-hmm. But I think that we've lost sight of the main threats and how we need to deal with those. Well, and feminism is another huge problem that we should.
Yeah, I mean, feminism. I'd like to talk also a little bit about egalitarianism and cultural relativism, because you've written extensively about those. But let's start with feminism, because the first wave feminists, you know, we need equal rights, men and women should be treated equally. I think these are now achievements.
Voting. Wave. Yeah.
Right.
Voting is first feminism. Yeah.
Right. And those were achieved fairly easily. The second wave was that we should shatter glass ceilings, that women should be allowed to study whatever they want, that men and women should be treated equally in terms of the opportunities afforded them.
Yeah, equity feminism is a good summary for the
right.
Quick summary for the second.
And you and I both like the work of Christina Hoff Sommers in this respect. But then the kind of feminism that we're going to talk about now is the third wave feminism, which has become this very poisonous, angry, misandrist philosophy, which I suppose some people would regard, just because it falls under the banner title of feminism, as being something that's an acceptable next stage evolution. Why is it a problem?
That's a great – I just want to comment on what you said first. People – you're absolutely correct, and people think because it falls under the banner of feminism that they have to support it, right? Because feminism is good, and then they forget the kind of the adjective that modifies it. Christina Hoff Sommers in The Factual Feminist details this at great length, intersectionality. It contributes to something you said in the beginning of our conversation, the victimhood Olympics. It contributes to identity politics – and the idea that people's utterances should be based upon some immutable characteristic of their birth, and they can't really understand something unless they have personal experience with it. And I'm not talking about, you know, fixing a car if you've never opened the hood of your car.
Right.
Identity. Yeah. So identity politics, intersectionality. The idea is basically that we all contribute to different elements of our identity, which is absolutely correct, and nobody could possibly disagree with that. The problem is that these become large echo chambers for – I'm even hesitant to use the word scholars – people who write papers in this field to other journals in this field that accept those works. And the consequently, people have basically made a discipline out of nothing, out of a house of cards. And it is coupled with a biology denialism. It's coupled with really rather disturbing elements of racism, even though they claim not to be racist. A friend of mine said something to me a little while ago. The only people – he said the only – I don't know if this is his original line or not, but the only people who care about race – are racists and leftists. And I think there's something very profound about that. I think there's something very profound about looking at somebody's race and then I do jiu-jitsu with guys, and whether or not they're black or, you know, whatever, Samoans, I mean, it doesn't – you can either execute the technique or you don't. Now, I do look at their weight, which is an immutable characteristic, right? But their race is utterly irrelevant. And so I think what you see happening in intersectionality is that you privilege certain aspects of those you perceive to be most oppressed. But here's the problem – here's among the problems that – here's my particular take on that – is that if you want enlightenment values to percolate through your society, if you want reason and rationality and people to be granted rights and dignity and essential personhood, you have to put aside the idea that people are reducible to their immutable characteristics. You have to put aside the idea that you can't understand a sort of a social event or phenomenon unless you have immediate and direct experience with that. Because if that's true, we could never have conversations with people who have experience with that, because we'd never be capable of understanding their experiences because we haven't had those experiences. So it gets back to what you said before. It's really they love the word privilege, but I'll borrow it from them. It's a privileging of subjectivity. It's when you're saying that your subjectivity should be privileged or should matter either more than objective facts or more than other people's subjectivity. But that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because everybody has it's like an alternative fact, which is really fascinating, because now these people have these post people, like by that I mean these people on the left, the postmodernists, the relativists, they have pushed this nonsense for so many years. But when somebody on the right comes and does it, then they throw a tizzy. But it's more or less the same thing. You know, an alternative fact is the Bowling Green Massacre. I mean, it's more or less the same thing. And that's the other thing, is the complete fabrication of reality and reality denialism only bothers those people if it's not a cherished conclusion that's being denied, right? So the creationist denies reality, and that upsets many people on the left, as well it should. The alternative facts people, how many people came out for Trump's inauguration in the crowds? More or less, I just saw a poll about a week ago. That didn't bother many people who, in fact, if I remember correctly, most people who supported Trump.
To some people, these rules are not a given in every argument or discussion. And to some people, their own feelings seem to play a much more important role. Now, are we prevented from having meaningful conversation with these people because of those preordained decisions from them about their feelings? Or is there a way to start talking to them? And I mean to ask you this as an educator.
That's an absolutely fantastic question. I'm not avoiding it. It's not the sort of question that can lend itself to yes or no. Here's my response to that. You can't have that question unless you have – you can't discuss that question unless you discuss a previous question. And that question should be, what role should truth play in people's lives? If you can have a conversation about that, then you've set the moral and intellectual groundwork to have subsequent conversations about free speech, about secularism, about whatever it is. But if somebody's just going to say, well, it's just my truth, or that's just how I feel, you'll never really get anywhere with that person. So you have to have another discussion before you have that discussion about, well, what role, how important is the truth? Should we believe true things? Do we want to believe true things? What about when we're faced with those situations in which believing true things would have bad emotional consequences for us? For example, what if we have a great relationship with our significant other and we have decided we're going to be in a monogamous relationship? Would you want to find out that that person was cheating on you? So we need to figure out, and it's perfectly okay for them to say no. It's not your business to tell them what their relationship to truth should be. You know, you can ask questions and help them examine their beliefs. But, you know, we're not hegemons here about someone's emotional lives with their partners. But if somebody is going to play the subjectivity card, you can't really have a discussion with them until you've had that discussion about truth.
Do you think, because you're one of the atheists who – you know, you've even written a book saying how to create an atheist. Now, do you think that atheism is something that is proselytizing? That atheism could be considered much like the religious people keep telling us, that we're going around because we believe in, you know, rationality, for example, and secularism, that we are going around converting people, and that that's as bad as when the religions convert people.
I've never understood that argument. I don't know any religion, and if you could think of one, please let me know, that values belief revision and epistemic humility. It's just an unusual question, because when I hear it, I'm always almost dumbfounded by how stupid it is. Respectfully, so it would be like proselytizing, not collecting stamps. I mean, how would you? I guess you could find somebody who collects stamps, and then tell them why they shouldn't collect stamps. But the difference is that collecting stamps is a hobby. It's not. It's like cheering for a particular football team. That's not a matter of fact which team should win. It's just a matter of taste.
Yeah.
So the conversation. So look. This is important. The conversation about atheism. Anybody who thinks that new atheism is about God as a conclusion doesn't really understand what new atheism is. New atheism is about epistemology and how people come to know what it is that they think that they know. And it's really a conversation about the role of evidence, the role evidence should play in one's belief life. And God is just one of the many conclusions that one could or could not come to based upon what one thinks or doesn't think evidence is. But there's no reason. Look, I was at Costco, but they have these, massive, I don't even know how many items are in this warehouse. And so I had just gone to Costco, and I placed my card, my Costco card. You need a special card to get your groceries out. I placed my card in the divider. You know how, like, when you go through the supermarket, there are those dividers and you take them so that you don't confuse people's groceries? And some guy picked up my card and thought it was his card. It was, you know, it was an honest mistake. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, that's my card." Mm-hmm. And he said, "No, it's not." And I was amazed by that. I simply could not believe that was an isolated incident with him. In other words, it wasn't about the card. But I think you could make a reasonable inference that he did that with other things in his life. Like, if someone said that to me, I would have just looked at the card, and the person is right or not. I'm not wedded to the fact that it's my card. In fact, why would I want to have a card that's not my card? It doesn't do me any good.
Yeah.
And I actually have to go to the trouble of finding my actual card. But that's the same thing with a God belief. Why, you know, people say, "Oh, no, it's true. It's just, I don't know if, let's talk about that. Oh, it's true." Okay, but the difference between a Costco card and a belief in God is, to say the least, rather significant. Whether or not you have a wrong Costco card is merely an inconvenience.
Yeah.
But whether or not you have a belief about a governing supernatural entity that affects virtually every aspect of your life, that is a very significant and substantive belief to harbor about the nature of reality. And so it's unclear to me the criticism that people give of whether or not it's proselytizing to help people be more reflective about the beliefs they have, because that's just as much in their interest to know what's true as it is in ours. It's just as much in that guy's interest to know if the Costco card is his than it is in my interest.
Well, yes, but then they'll turn it on you and say to you, "Well, you're horrible and you're mean because you're trying to stop people from believing in things that comfort them."
Okay, that's a completely legitimate criticism. That's fantastic. Now let's have a conversation about what role truth should play in one's life. Is it more important to believe true things or to be comfortable? I would make the argument that unless you believe true things, you can't really be comfortable, and that your comfort is illusory. Because what happens is you're creating features internal to your life that you think will bring about your well-being and flourishing, but won't. It would be like harboring the belief that eating, macaroni salad all day, because I happen to like macaroni salad. I've been sick. I've been eating a ton of macaroni salad. Will actually lead to good physical health. But it's not a true belief. So if you have a belief that's false, you may think that that belief gives you comfort until you slowly gain weight and get diabetes, right? So it's important to make sure that in your belief life, you believe things that are true. And you know what? That shouldn't be a controversial statement. That's yeah. not some kind of hegemony of going out and forcing people to believe anything.
Right.
That's not, you know, punching people in the face like many people are advocating. This is just what it means to live in a civil society, in a democracy, in which people's votes, the way that people vote affects me and you directly. And we all want to believe true things. And if you don't want to believe true things, then let's be honest about that. Let's just say, you know what? It's less important to me that I believe true things than I believe something that comforts me.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who says that, I might not respect that belief, but I respect them for being honest with me, because now I know exactly where they stand.
Well, Peter, this is probably going to be one of many conversations I hope that we'll have in the future. Please continue to do your good work. There are too few voices that are nonpartisan. You find yourself in a room agreeing or finding common ground with people who you probably ideologically have no commonality with. I think that the ideas that you're espousing and that people like you, and there are few of them, are putting out there are enormously helpful in a world where there seems to be an attack on truth, where there seems to be a move against secularism, and where religion continues to pose a very real danger to people's health and livelihood and existence.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on your show and to communicate with your viewers and your listeners in South Africa in particular. I've never been to South Africa, but it's a place I've wanted to visit for quite some time. So I really do want to thank you and your listeners for listening to our chat and giving me the opportunity to speak with you. So thanks so much. CliffCentral.com.